I found this talk incredibly challenging, and some people would be quite surprised for me to find it incredibly challenging, because I've just co-written a book with a psychiatrist, Dr. Paramananda Groves, on the topic of eight-step recovery using the Buddha's teachings to overcome addiction. But I really did find it quite challenging. And I think in a way, because, you know, with addictions, it's quite easy for me to separate myself out from that and say, oh, well, addictions, I don't have that. But when I look at it from the perspective of intoxicants, I can really see that actually I do have a relationship with intoxicants. But before we get into the fifth precept, I just really just wanted to speak a bit generally, because we are closing with this final precept. So, Sarika's talk was just great for me. It just had so much clarity. And her talk just really made me realize how I've changed. And I think it's really important to mark change. I think sometimes we change and we don't mark it. But it's really good and important to mark change. But also, it's important to keep on making changes. I think sometimes we say, yay, we've changed, and that's it, we settle for that. But it's important to keep on making those changes. One of the things which really struck me in Sarika's talk was when she referred to the three level of ethical observances, and she applied them specifically to the speech precept. So, you know, when I was going through them, I was just like, oh, generally, how do I apply these ethical observances to all the precepts? So, you know, a question I have for all of us, so where are we with each precept on the level of the three ethical observances? And she spoke about, firstly, when we don't think anything about our unskillful actions, but we don't do it if we know we will get caught. Secondly, she mentioned, we might consider our actions as unskillful, but we don't live our life in accordance with the precepts. And thirdly, we wouldn't even consider committing an unskillful action, committing breaking any of the precepts. So for me, it was just really interesting because, you know, as I said, I can really see how I've changed, but her talk really made me realize I've got a lot of changing to do. I live in Vancouver, and we have a truss system on the transportation, so there are no barriers. And so you can just actually walk through without not paying. They do have ticket inspectors, but you can walk through. And I mean, I know very clearly that traveling on the train without a ticket is, you know, unskillful. And so, you know, I don't do it. But the motivation behind it is that the fear of being caught, and especially this older member being caught. So it's not really the right motivation. And it doesn't always come up, but I am aware sometimes it's like, okay, remember to get your ticket, it'd be awful if I get caught. So I've got some work to do with that, you know. And so it's just great for me to actually see that and see the work that I still really need to do around taking the not given. But I say, you know, I have changed because I was someone who lived on the streets from the age of 14. I made that choice. It was a safer choice for me to live on the streets. And I survived through pickpocketing and shoplifting. And I knew it was wrong, but, you know, when you live that street culture, you don't consider it unethical because it's the way you survive. You either do that or you get into prostitution. But, you know, it was an unskillful thing to do, and I was locked up for 18 months of my life for that, for shoplifting. So wasn't that great at it, obviously, because I got caught several times. But I can say today that I wouldn't even contemplate pickpocketing or stealing from a shop or a person. I mean, it just doesn't come into my mind. So I can really see clearly how I have changed. But as I said, I've still got changes to do. There is that pull of taking a grape in a shop. You know, when I'm walking by, and do I pick a grape and eat it and tell myself, oh, I'm testing that grape, you know? So, yeah. And, you know, what stops me from doing it is that motivation of the fear of somebody seeing me doing it. So I still have work to do in that area. Yeah. So today's talk, we're focusing on Sumeria, Maja, Pana Datana, Veremini, Sikhapadan, Samar Diyami. I undertake to abstain from taking intoxicants. With mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my body. I can quite honestly say that I do not contemplate a drink. So this actually feels quite liberating for me, but I still have to keep practicing. One will not know until we reach the point of our demise if we have freed ourselves from samsara. I can only have faith in the practice that if a crisis arises, that I would not be triggered into an old habitual behavior. My intention of this talk is for you to all reflect on your relationship to intoxicants. So I share my own practice to explore this precept, and obviously it's my point of view. So one of the things that I believe in is that we are all renunciates, whether we're on the spiritual path or not. We all have to let go of everything when we die. We can't take our favourite belongings with us, or indeed the money we have in the bank. We have to let go of everything. We either choose to begin letting go now or do the big letting go at the point of death. Why cling on? Thich Nhat Hanh says, the only things we own are our actions. And so if you believe in rebirth, then if you cling onto your habits to the bitter end, then you will be put right back on the wheel of suffering. We will be like the hungry ghost, unable to imagine life without that odd glass of wine. Stephen Levine says, an end of a meal, an end of relationships, are mini rehearsals for death. And if we begin to let go of our intoxicants, we will be well on the path of dying in peace and with a calm mind. So, the big A. When we speak about this precept, we think of the big A, alcohol. This is only part of it, but inevitably, a lot of my talk is going to focus on alcohol because this precept traditionally focuses on alcohol and drugs. So, in my talk, I'm not talking to the alcoholic because it's clear that this is an issue. What I believe is, if we learn to train our minds in renouncing intoxicants, we will be moving in the direction of wisdom. Bhikshuni Thubten Shodron says, we live in a world where we cling by thinking or saying, I want when I want it, it doesn't matter what I do to get it. I say, we want what we want when we want it, and in the moment we want it, we act on it. And we don't care about the consequences. Now you may think, well, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm an occasional drinker. I just drink once a week. But another occasional drinker says, well, I just drink once a month. And another occasional drinker will say, well, I just drink at Christmas and at important celebrations. And of course, if you drink more than this, you still won't give yourself the label of an alcoholic. Alcoholism is a label I do not add to my list. But yes, I have had a relationship to alcohol. In fact, I enjoyed champagne, or the poor man's champagne that my friends delightfully call kavar. But I was aware that whenever I drank, I was prone to unmindfulness of speech, body and mind. I undertake to abstain from taking intoxicants. This principle clearly states that we need to move towards letting go of intoxicants. But the human mind likes to cling on, delude ourselves that if we only drink occasionally, it doesn't matter. In fact, we became so deluded in the old days of the FWBO that this precept changed from undertaking to abstain from taking intoxicants to undertaking to abstain from intoxicants that cloud the mind. How convenient. As I said in my first talk on sexual misconduct, these five precepts are what connects all Buddhist traditions together. And although they may be phrased differently, nowhere is it written that I have found cloud the mind. But beware, somewhere at some time, I'm sure it will come into print. I wrote to Bante Sangharakshita a few months ago, requesting he put the fifth precept back in for order members at the point of ordination, so that we take 11. He wrote back and said, and I quote, "I am in agreement with you regarding the 11th precept, but I'm not in a position to impose it on the order unilaterally. You will need to discuss it with the order." What prompted me to write to Bante is that there is so much energy in our tradition about vegetarianism, not smoking, while we still accept it is okay to continue drinking if we don't identify as an alcoholic. Also, the final push was when a friend in the Sangha said, "Ha, so when you become an order member, you don't have to worry about drinking." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, it's not in your 10 precepts, is it?" And so although we can argue that it is embedded in the 10, it is not there. But let's not delude ourselves, because every order member formally took the precept when they became a mitra. There is a teaching in Buddhism called the Four Reminders. The first one tells us we have a precious birth because we have been born in a human form and at the time when the teachings of the Buddha are available. So how are we living our life? If our life is precious, are we living it to our full potential? Are we present in our life? Do we recognize when we break a precept? Do we acknowledge when we break a precept, or just say, "Ah, well, that's how I choose to live my life"? The fundamental question we need to ask ourselves is, are we living our life full of words of loving kindness and with open-handed generosity and with stillness, simplicity and contentment and with words kindly and gracious and with truthful speech and with our minds full of mindfulness clear and radiant? If we answer no to any of these, even if it is a no, but I'm changing, and most of the time it's a yes, then there is still work we have to do with living our life in line with the precepts. Those of us who took the five precepts in the mitra ceremony or in a ceremony in another Buddhist tradition and continue to not acknowledge when we are breaking them, we are more deluded than the people who have not taken them in a formal public ceremony. This is because we woke up to an inspiration of wanting to live our lives more and more in line with the precepts, marked them publicly, and are now pretending to be asleep. This is ignorance. It's better to have never woken up than to have woken up and then pretended to be asleep. In the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, he actually advises people, if they know they are still attached to alcohol and do not want to let go of it entirely and still want that occasional drink, then best just take the first four on and wait until you're willing to let go. And with that occasional drink, he advises, drink with mindfulness, because when a crisis occurs in our lives, our drinking habits may change. In the Vibhanga Sutta, it states that even as little as a drop the size of a dewdrop on the tip of a blade of grass is enough to constitute a violation of the precept abstaining to take intoxicants. So how best to make use of this precious birth? How much time do we want to waste playing a game with our ethical life? Such ignorance will block our way to overcome the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, block our way of breaking the fourth and fifth mental bonds of hatred and craving, and certainly hinder wisdom emerging within our hearts. We use excuses all the time. It's something I just do with the family. It's part of the work culture. I just like one glass after my evening meal. Well, the experts say one shot of brandy a day is good for your health. How many of you measure the shot? Traditionally, this precept has focused on alcohol and addiction. And it seems a lot more clearer for most people that drugs are a no-no, unless, of course, you are a dope smoker. However, there are, of course, exceptions. Intoxicants as medicines are not seen as breaking the precepts. What the Venerable Faxon says in his book, Buddhist Ethics for Modern Living, he says the most important thing is the intellectual catalyst leading to the physical act of consuming alcohol. I say that again. What's important is the intellectual catalyst leading to the physical act of consuming alcohol. We are very good at calling people an alcoholic or saying that person drinks too much. Often it's in comparison to our own drinking behaviour. 12 years ago, I had a contract to deliver an anger management program to women who were sent to rehab instead of prison due to committing crimes under the influence of intoxicants. In fact, the biggest cause of women committing crimes is due to them taking drugs or drinking alcohol. Anyway, in this job, there was a point where me and my co-trainer were exploring addictions and abstinence. And I became aware at the break of my co-trainer standing there and smoking. And in that point, I realized that I and my co-trainer were no different from the women we were working with. I stopped perceiving them as alcoholics and perceived them as people who drank and they got out of control. And in that moment, I said to myself, I'm telling these women they need to stop drinking, but do I believe it's possible to stop drinking? And so I experimented. I decided to stop drinking for 1 year. I stopped for 18 months. And then I had a glass of champagne with friends. And one of my friends said, oh, you're so funny. And in that moment, I could see that one glass of champagne had loosened my tongue and my humour was that of the tone of the unskillful, sarcastic nature. A few months later, someone asked me if I drank and I said proudly, only champagne. And in that moment, I could see it was part of my ego, and I just thought, that's just so sad. So 11 years ago, I made a decision to let go of alcohol and live more in line with the fifth precept. The issue with alcohol is that, yes, we may well not feel intoxicated, but alcohol often leads us to breaking our precepts. As I've cited earlier, When we have a glass or two, our speech can become harsh. We can take the not given, and we can cause harm and not be generous. This is why we need to pay attention to this precept. So I ask you, how many of you have had your first night of sex with a new partner without being under the influence of an intoxicant? How often do we find ourselves in bed with someone after we have had a couple of glasses of wine, a joint, or another substance? I know for myself that in the past, I woke up next to someone, and because sex was such a strong pull, I ended up in a relationship that should never have happened. I've also woken up next to someone and thought, how did I get here? And if I'd not been under the influence of an intoxicant, I would most definitely have not gone, well, I most definitely would have gone home to my own bed. Alcohol is known as the best and cheapest intoxicant for taking down inhibitions. Even after one glass of wine, we say and do things we wouldn't normally do. I have recently learned to drive in Canada, and part of our training is 2 hours of watching the results of drink driving. On my first day, the lady walked in and said, you stand up. And I was thinking, don't pick me. So I got picked. And she said to us, in your first year of driving, this amount of you will be in an accident. And you know why? Because most accidents are caused by an impaired mind. We are told 2 units of wine can impair our judgment because it slows our reaction down. This means that this same amount of wine will impact all our communications in the rest of our lives. If our livers are healthy, it will take 1 hour for the effect to wear off. However, it would be unskillful to focus just on alcohol in this talk. Today, intoxicants cover a wide range of things, from food, to the internet, to texting on the phone, basically something that impairs the mind from being mindful. So texting or speaking on the phone while driving will be considered an intoxicant. And believe me, in my driving education, I saw the results of that. In North America, distracted driving and aggressive driving are among the top 5 most common causes for car accidents. When I let go of what I called my gross intoxicants, alcohol, recreational substances, and my biggest intoxicants, I was a bulimic anorectic for many years. And still today, I know when I overeat, I actually feel intoxicated. My mind is impaired, and my mobility is not as grounded, and my mind not clear, and I can be harsh in communication. But, as I said, when I let go of these gross intoxicants, I had a shock to find that my biggest intoxicant was, guess what? My stinking thinking. Thinking that tells me stories. Thinking that can make me angry. Thinking that literally intoxicates my mind and impairs the mind. This thinking causes conflict. We speak harshly. We lash out with anger and resentment. We are the person who can be meditating in the shrine room. We've had a great sit. We walk out of the shrine room. Somebody upsets our equilibrium and we act harshly. We are the person sitting in the shrine room meditating and we hear noise and we begin to get irritated and begin to thinking harshly, trying to cling on to our peaceful moment. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, it's not the noise that makes us angry, we make the noise angry. Murders, physical violence, revenge, resentment, and much of human action is fueled by our stinking thinking. So we have to take this on seriously. When we clean our lives out of the grosser intoxicants, we can begin to work on our stinking thinking. When we let go of this intoxicant, it is inevitable that we will dwell in less negative mental states. Our focus needs to be on our thoughts in this precept. I spent a lifetime trying to control my main intoxicant, food, and not making much progress. I've watched others trying to control their alcohol, drugs, without success. Why? Because we are powerless over our intoxicants. There is no controller. We are powerless over our thoughts. We can't control our thoughts. But when we realize this, we realize that what we need to be aware of is our thoughts. Watch them subtly arise. Observe the thought that speaks, I want a glass of wine. I want that cookie. Observe the thought that says, I want that extra plate of food. And know that there is no substance to these thoughts. There is nothing to believe. And let the thought cease into emptiness. This is the practice of mindfulness clear and radiant. If we believe the thought, we will identify with it. We will think it's real and act it out, and therefore break our commitment to the precepts. You may be one of those people where you hold your alcohol well. People wouldn't even know you were tipsy because it feels normal, and you wouldn't even know you were tipsy because it feels normal. And you only drink in the confines of your home, so who cares? If we act in contradiction to our ethical principles, our actions leave seeds in the mind, which can lead to anger and resentment. When we let go of our intoxicants, we begin to see things as they really are. Our intoxicants obscure reality. When the obscurations dissolve, we begin to realize that in the seen is only the seen. In the heard is only the heard. No stories, no nothing, just emptiness. We should practice our ethical behavior in the manner of the Maranasati Sutta. We should practice just as one's clothes or head had caught fire, would put forth extraordinary desire, effort, zeal, enthusiasm, indefatigability, mindfulness, and clear comprehension to extinguish the fire on her clothes or head, so that the practitioner should put forth extraordinary desire, effort, zeal, enthusiasm, indefatigability, mindfulness, and clear comprehension to abandon those bad, unwholesome qualities. In the spirit of the Buddha's words, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of texts, by logic, by inferential thinking, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think. The ascetic is our teacher. But when you know yourselves, these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise. These things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should engage in them. When you know for yourself that these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness, then you should enter and remain them. Thank you.